Hello, everybody. It's Alan Shartok, and I'm here at 208 and 49 seconds. Welcome back to the Vox Pop. In the studio today on this Medical Monday is the best of the best, Dr. Mark Pettis, Chief of Medicine at St. Peter's Hospital in Albany, New York. He's a clinical associate professor of medicine at the University of Massachusetts Medical School and the former medical director of the Kripalu Institute for Integrated Healing, located in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Dr. Pettis is the author of two books, The Savvy Patient, The Ultimate Advocate for Quality Healthcare, and It's All in Your Head, Change Your Mind, Change Your Health. Dr. Pettis, welcome back to the program. To be part of today's conversation, give us a call at 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. I know of no other physician who has the sort of comprehensive view of medicine that Mark does, and it's always an incredible pleasure to have him with us. What's it like to be chief of medicine at St. Peter's? Does everybody do exactly what you tell them?
Well, I wish that was the case, Alan. It's a very busy time right now. A lot of exciting and positive things happening at St. Peter's and St. Peter's Health Partners, this new merger.
It makes St. Peter's the largest deliverer of health care in the capital region?
The St. Peter's Health Partners is now the largest provider of care, over 12,000 employees and four acute care hospitals, skilled nursing, home care, the Eddy. It's a large system.
Wow.
It's exciting.
Well, I know nothing of trying to expand your influence, but it must be exciting. 1-800-348-2551. Okay, let's go to phone number one, Tim in Gilderland. Okay, Tim, you're on.
Hi, Alan. Thank you.
Sure.
This is a little bit beyond the subject, but if the doctor has, Dr. Pettis has an opinion on this, I have wondered for decades why oncologists have not been able to identify and isolate a cancer cell and differentiate it from a healthy cell and attack it and kill it. I realize this is a little beyond, he's not an oncologist, he's a great physician, but I wonder if he has an opinion on that. He may not.
Just in terms of qualifying your question, because it sounded like you were saying, why can't they find a cancer cell? Well, of course, they can find cancer cells. The real question that you're asking, I take it, Tim, is why can't they just kill it, right?
Identify, isolate, and kill it.
It's a provocative question, Tim. I think that the holy grail of cancer research is certainly to develop therapies that can systemically throughout the body make more intelligent distinctions between a cancer cell and a non-cancer cell. And we're certainly not at that point yet, though. We're on the front end of this golden age of molecular research where scientists and medical oncologists are getting more very specific genetic or genomic, as it's referred to, information about cancer cells. And this is already leading to a lot of research that is attempting to develop therapies that can target markers that are specific to those cancer cells. And that would allow these therapies to eradicate that which is bad and preserve that which is good, which, as you allude to, is still a bit of a challenge.
But we've been waiting for so long for this to happen. We keep being told, I think Tim would agree, this is coming.
Yeah.
Well, where is it?
Well, it's complicated. And I think one of the things that we've learned from the genomic research of the last 10 years is that everyone hoped that we would find a cancer gene. And as it turns out, there is no specific cancer gene.
Well,
there are some genes that are associated with cancers, but the genetic complexity, I think, is far greater than what people anticipated.
So in breast cancer, haven't we found the gene?
There is a well-known gene that puts women at increased risk.
Yeah,
it's called the BRCA gene, the BRCA gene. But we know that there are some women that have the gene that never get cancer. Many women who get breast cancer don't have that particular gene. So it's not as straightforward, I think, as we would hope it to be.
Tim, one fast follow up. Go ahead.
So for layman like me, it's like we're not at the point where we can actually identify and isolate a cancerous cell.
Well, cancer cells can certainly...
A cancerous cell.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few stages along the way between a transformation from a normal cell to a cancerous cell. And there are some techniques. I mean, the pap smear continues to be a time-tested method of identifying cancer cells or cells that are in transition or transformation that can identify women who, if they don't have cancer, are at much greater risk of acquiring it. So that's one example of some instances where that distinction is made clinically.
Well, but I don't understand something. If I have Barrett's disease, which I do,
mm-hmm.
And somebody looks at it under a microscope, they can differentiate from normal cell dysplasia, cancer cells, can't they?
Yes, they can. They can. And so there you're making the distinction between, you mentioned the word dysplastic.
Yeah.
And that, I think most clinicians would see that as a high risk of a cell population that is in transition, if you will, from a normal state to a cancerous state. So we do have that capacity for, you know, most of the pathology that we obtain. Tissue from biopsies, whether it be the esophagus in the case of Barrett's, or a pap smear, pathologists have far more tools in addition to just visualizing a cell under the microscope, which has many characteristics that can allow you to distinguish cancer from non-cancer. There are many of these markers, these molecular markers that can render a personality to a cell that may better distinguish that which is normal from that which is precancerous to those that are, an established cancer.
And yet what Tim is asking is the question everybody's been asking for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't we just have the magic bullet that goes right to the, differentiates, goes right to the, and that's what they're working on, right?
Yeah, exactly. And and I say it's complicated, it's a bit of an understatement. Cancers are very individual. So two women, each of whom has breast cancer, may have a very different type of cancer in terms of its biology, in terms of its markers, some of these molecular markers. So there is no one type of cancer. These have a multitude of individual markers that can influence how these are diagnosed and ultimately how they're treated.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
Let's go to Maeve. Is it Maeve and Ryan Cliff?
Hi.
Rhinebeck? Yeah.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I'm actually in the car with my 18-month-old son on my way to the doctor. I figured I might as well call and ask you your opinion as well.
Well, I hope you're talking through the steering wheel and not on the phone.
Of course.
Yeah.
So my son, who is asleep, his skin is very reactive. I know some people call that atopic. And it seems like when he eats certain things, he breaks out around his face, sometimes on his back, then it goes away quickly. And I don't have any allergies. Nobody in my family has any allergies. And I was just wondering, from an integrative, holistic approach, what the doctor's approach is to treating a child who is atopic in that way.
Well, yeah. You've come to the right guy. I'll tell you that right now, because, as you know, he was the head of the Kripalu Medical Group. And certainly, this is an area he knows a lot about. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I think it's a common scenario, Maeve. I'm not a pediatrician, but I think the principles in terms of addressing an adult that has a hypersensitivity, if you will, is probably not unlike that which you would confront in an 18-month-old.
Whoops. Go ahead.
We know that there are many things in our food supply that people are more sensitive to, and these can range from most commonly cow's milk and dairy. If you look at the casein proteins in cow's milk continue to change based on the way that our cows are fed so the quality of the proteins in the milk can shift, leaving some people more sensitive. Gluten is an area of active interest, most commonly found in wheat and also in rye and barley. Gluten sensitivity, as opposed to celiac, which is a more severe allergy to gluten, is probably a more common than appreciated cause of allergic reaction. There's also a lot of interest in the ecosystem of the gut and how that might influence food sensitivities and allergies. So here, you know, the interest is in this microbiome, as it's referred to, which are the normal bacterial flora in the gut. And we know that, and I'm more familiar with the adult literature, adults that are atopic often have a different type of bowel flora. So allergy testing is important. I sometimes recommend an elimination trial in an 18-month-old. It's very important that they're getting adequately nourished, so one doesn't want to eliminate to the point of compromising appropriate protein and nutrients. But I think dairy and gluten are two very big and often overlooked sources of allergy. And many people who I think are atopic are being provoked by those types of foods. And then again, with respect to the gut, there I would be thinking about maybe a trial of probiotics. And again, I can't speak with a great deal of experience in the 18-month-old population, but in adults, it can be a very effective way of changing the way our body responds immunologically. It can sort of dampen that inflammatory response.
Mark Pettis, we lost Maeve. She was on the car phone, and yeah. I think maybe she saw, you know, something that made her hang up.
Yeah.
Like a cop. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Maeve. And we'll come right back. I just wanted to mention that the telephone number here is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And your chances of getting through are excellent, I tell you, excellent.
Support for WAMC comes from the Sterling and Francine Clark Art Institute, Williamstown, Massachusetts, presenting the Carpe Diem String Quartet on Tuesday, August 14th, clarkart.edu for tickets. Windy Hill Farm, Orchard, Nursery and Garden Shop, Route 7, Great Barrington, featuring Pick Your Own and Fresh Picked Blueberries from Windy Hill's Fields, windyhillfarminc.com. And Saratoga Bridges, Boston Spa, New York, a community resource for people with disabilities and their families, supported employment, day services, and more, saratogabridges.org.
And we are back. Thank you, everybody, for calling. You know, there's one free phone left, and let's go to John in Gloversville, where nobody goes around barehanded. Right, John?
Sure. That's what they say. Anyway, this is about lower back pain, which probably half the people would have it. Sometimes I couldn't walk. I told the surgeon I was seeing, he was a surgeon, but he was a doctor I was seeing, and he said it's basically wear and tear. I have to live with it, and of course, if you're basically immobile, he said get used to it. Well, it scared me a little bit. I lost over 100 pounds. I ended up hiking and snowshoeing all over the place and being very active. I've been to three physical therapy sessions and two, which I thought were quite good and well done, and three chiropractors. And by the time I'd get to the door to go into my car, it would be just like it was. Bending to put on shoes and socks can be kind of iffy, and knee pain seems to come with it. Sometimes it's just plain hard to walk. I'm older, obviously, so it could be just wear now. But the thing is, it almost seems like a virus sometimes. I just went through the Lyme system because I have had the bullseye thing and spent a lot of time throughout my life out of doors, and I did develop what looked like, from the pictures I've seen, the shingles spotting there, and my doctor thought she had seen, you know, scarring from it. So I mean, we're aware of that, but this is probably an unanswerable question, right?
Well, it certainly a very common issue, John.
Yes.
as I know you know, and I think, and I don't want to oversimplify the issue, but I generally try to make the distinction between back pain that has more imminent, neurologic implications. Mm-hmm. So, here, you're making the distinction between somebody who has back pain, and in addition, you know, they're getting chronic sort of sciatica, the pain going into the leg, or they're starting to notice some weakness or problems with their bowel or bladder function. All of these raise more imminent concerns of a neurologic impingement or entrapment, which, without some intervention, you know, could be more problematic in terms of permanent, you know, neurologic injury.
Spinal?
Yes.
Okay.
As opposed to, you know, the overwhelming majority of these issues are mechanical, indeed. So that you do get the wear and tear of the vertebrae, you do get. The discs between the vertebrae tend to flatten out a little bit. They lose their resiliency, their suppleness. And I think just because most of us aren't attentive to ergonomics throughout the day, how we stand, how we sit, and don't stretch and move our bodies in ways that, you know, our ancient ancestors did with much greater frequency, it's created just this epidemic of challenges around back. I too have chronic back issues.
Me too.
You mentioned a lot of really positive things with the movement, the activity, the physical therapy. I do think for anyone who's having progressive pain with any of those neurologic findings, sometimes you need to just break down and get the MRI of the lower back to look.
I have had them. I apologize for interrupting you.
Yeah.
And I went for a second opinion to, I guess, a well-respected doctor at Ellis. And my original surgeon wasn't too happy that I asked for that. I wasn't trying to be offensive.
Yeah.
But the thing is, if I was going to be immobile the rest of my life, I hadn't even retired yet. That's pretty scary.
Yes.
And you know, when you think quality of life, et cetera. And my kids are growing up, and I don't want them taking care of me anyway. But they had their own lives. But the thing is, he said that it wasn't operable yet or something, or, you know. But if you can't walk, I mean, how much worse can it get?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
If a person can't walk because they have neurologic weakness, that's a true emergency, as opposed to challenges walking because of pain, and not to mitigate the importance of that.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But I do think that, you know, motion is the lotion, and I often do. I mean, some things that you might want to think about would be yoga.
Did yoga 2 sessions, and I actually stopped because I was frustrated. I was frustrated with myself. No one else was frustrated with me, at least that, you know, they claimed they weren't, because there were certain things I couldn't do,
yeah.
Like stretching, you know, doing that one where you make like a V with your rear end,
yeah.
And your legs are up and your hands are up, and that would just kill my back. Sometimes I could do it. Sometimes it would just kill my back. So.
Yeah.
Certain things I couldn't do frustrated me, but I enjoyed yoga, especially the rest time.
Right. Well, I think there it's a matter of sort of modifying what you're doing to what your pain and limitations allow you to do. You know, people who teach yoga would say there is no right or wrong. It's
right.
A matter of finding your sort of zone of comfort and limitation.
And they were very good, yeah.
You may find acupuncture. Some people find
really?
That can be very helpful.
I tried. It didn't work.
And, you know,
okay.
Chiropractors often can help with some manipulation as well. So,
well, that didn't, it would work temporarily, but then right. I would plead with them not to touch my lower back.
No.
I can't even sit in a car that has like that special lumbar stuff in it.
Yes.
And even my packs, people would ask why I ride my pack so low on my back, because any pressure on my lower back, forget it.
Hey, John, thanks for the call.
I'm sorry.
All right. We just want to take some other calls.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much. And we all join you in your pain. I certainly do.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, John. Okay, now your chances are 4 out of 5 of getting in. Right now, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to No, that can't be right. That can't be right. What phone is she on? Well, okay, let's try Michelle. Michelle, are you on?
I am. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Michelle.
Thank you, both of you. So some of my symptoms or issues are very similar to the last caller. I had an accident about 15 years ago. Someone drove about 55 miles into the back of my car without stopping at a red light.
Wow.
And so my spine, I've always had some issues. I guess my lumbar area was kind of cockeyed. So I've gone to the chiropractor, done all of that, and I work out my back muscles. So And I've also had 5 children and 4 out of which an epidural with them. So I think just naturally back pain just, you know, comes with getting older. The past couple of years I've gone through, I lost a child. Mm. I went through a layoff with a very large company during 2008 and was kind of displaced, and domestic violence. So,
oh, goodness.
I just had a very tough couple of years, and so I've haven't paid attention to my body and my health. I've kind of just mothered my children to get us through it. So about a week ago, I had this debilitating pain that had been leading up and getting worse. I've started getting healthier the past month with walking and bike riding. I've put on about 100 pounds. I'm 35 and 247 pounds. So I've been trying. And last week, I just lost function in the right side of my body, and it was kind of felt like I had a Novocaine shot on the side of my face. So, and I fell down a flight of stairs. So I was in the hospital. They ran all of these tests, and from that came all of these health concerns. My stomach was very bloated. I had blood in my urine. And my kidney levels were 75%. I'm normally a very healthy person.
Mm.
So I guess I'm just very, very nervous. And then the interim, you know, appointments to get into the neurologist take time. The text came back for Lyme disease and all of that, and I don't have it. But they think I may have MS. The x-rays, the MRI of my brain or CAT scan of my brain was fine. But they think I may have MS. Potentially rheumatoid arthritis. They could see some arthritis.
Michelle, is Alan.
Yes.
I'm just gonna, because we have such a lineup of people, I'm gonna ask Mark to sort of give a reaction to this, recognizing, of course, that something this complex is not something that anybody can do who without being seen. But Mark.
Yeah. Yeah, so just off the top, Michelle, hard not to be profoundly impressed with just the magnitude of stress and sort of trauma that you've been experiencing over the last few years from what you describe. That alone can take one's immune system and turn it on its head. And while it's hard for me to know whether what you describe could be MS or not, it sounds like they're still in the process of trying to get more testing and evaluation. You know, the MS is an autoimmune disease, and you know, if they were raising questions of MS or rheumatoid, you know, blood in the urine, sometimes these can be a manifestation of a sort of a systemic, the body's autoimmune or an inflammatory response. And so the first goal is to try to just get to the bottom of it, if one can, with testing. Recognizing that from a self-care perspective, I think what's most important is that you really try to focus in terms of your diet. And again, I often steer people toward an anti-inflammatory diet, which is more of a plant-based diet, you know, moderating dairy, moderating gluten. You know, there may be some other nutritional issues. Vitamin D is very important. The gut bacteria, probiotics can be very important. These are all sort of factors that can sometimes influence a body's systemic immune or inflammatory response. Clearly, there's something not quite right there. And MS is on the list of possibilities with what you describe. But it sounds like you need more information in terms of determining exactly what's going on. But what's clear is that your body is telling you that there is a need to the extent that one can in one's chaotic life, to sort of pause and sort of take inventory of how, you know, the environmental inputs in your life may be impacting your health.
Absolutely. And I think that was the reason for my call. It just so happened I was leaving the chiropractor and you were on the radio. And I love this show. But so the reason I called is mainly it really just scared me because there is no support system for my children. Mm. I have one leaving for law school and, you know, one working out of diapers. So I cannot afford to be sick.
Mm.
And I really, it just made me, smack me in the face and said I need to get healthy because I'm all they have.
Yeah.
So my question is really, I have an appointment with a nutritionist at the end of the month. Mm-hmm. I started going back to my chiropractor, and I've worked myself off of the ibuprofen and Flexerol.
Excellent.
What else can I do while I'm working, waiting to get into the neurologist and all of these MRI appointments? What can I do to just be healthy without causing another reaction? Should I, do swimming?
Okay,
Michelle. Your nutrition advice, yes?
Again, I don't want to cut anybody off, and somebody will always call me and say you were rude or whatever.
Sorry.
To me, you're not rude. But I got four people behind you, and I want to make sure we try to get to everybody. So go ahead.
So very quickly, Michelle. I mean, movement, particularly any movement that might be enjoyable to you. Swimming is wonderful because it's non-weight bearing. You really get a good exercise. Yoga is a superb form of movement and breath. I think you may find an added advantage of yoga is there's a meditative component to it.
Sure.
The breath and that mindfulness meditation could be extremely important for you just in terms of the stress that you confront, day to day. I think it sounds like nutritionally you're doing a pretty good job. You may want to try an elimination of gluten and dairy if you're able to navigate that. With your kids, they don't have to do this, but that may help you. And the extent to which you can leverage whatever social network of friends, family, faith community, if relevant, I think anything you can do to leverage that network to help support you as you sort of navigate this is going to be extremely important.
Michelle, get to some doctors
and good
luck to you. Thanks.
Thank you. God bless.
Right. You too.
Let's go to Susan in New Paltz. Susan, you're on.
Hi, my name is Susan, and last week or a couple weeks ago, I had some abdominal pain and was diagnosed with gallstones and gallbladder disease. And my question to you is if there's anything other than having your gallbladder removed that you can do to sort of reverse gallbladder disease. And beyond that, if I do decide to have my gallbladder out, is there anything that I can do after that to sort of, I consider myself pretty healthy. I eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. I'm a 41-year-old female. I weigh 123 pounds. I'm not overweight. I consider myself eating pretty healthy. I don't eat a lot of fat. I do love eggs and butter, but I don't eat fried foods. I don't eat a lot of red meat. So I'm just wondering if there's anything. I guess I'm concerned about what caused these gallstones to begin with, and maybe it's just hereditary. But any advice you have on gallbladder disease would be helpful.
Yeah, and it sounds like you're doing a lot of good things, Susan, just from a self-care perspective. Gallstones are just so very common, and as we concentrate the bile in our gallbladder, these often are crystals of cholesterol and bile acids, bile salts, that just frequently, become stones. And there's only one medicine approved by the FDA that I'm aware of for gallstones. It's called Actigal. It works by dissolving stones, though I have to say I've been very underwhelmed not at all impressed by much of what has been published in terms of just how effective Actigal is. It's not a medicine ordinarily that I would prescribe, nor would I recommend a loved one take it for gallstones. I think unfortunately, removing the gallbladder with the stones is the only ultimate solution. If you are having pain that is simply interfering with your quality of life, some people have gallstones but are totally asymptomatic with them. But if it should be symptoms that drive the decision to remove a gallbladder, most people without a gallbladder do perfectly well because they continue to make bile and they continue to excrete that bile into the intestinal tract, which is, functionally what you want to happen. So removing a gallbladder doesn't affect that process at all. So it's largely symptoms that would determine whether or not to go to the point of surgery.
Okay, very quickly then, Mark, what does a gallbladder do again?
A gallbladder basically is a repository for the bile that the liver produces, and after we consume a meal, the gallbladder contracts to push that bile into the intestinal tract, which essentially helps us digest our food and absorb food, particularly, fatty foods. So it helps with digestion.
So the stupidest question I'm going to ask today is, what is bile?
Bile is, these are acids, essentially, that, again, have properties that allow foods like fat to be broken down into smaller constituents that can be better absorbed or excreted. The bile also is very important in terms of sort of detoxification. Many things that we eliminate through our intestinal tract require the bile acids to sort of help facilitate their elimination. So there's an important role
there. So isn't it
the
liver, though, that detoxifies?
The liver does most of the detoxification in terms of how it affects various things, both in the environment that get into our system, as well as things that we produce as a consequence of our metabolism internally. The liver also makes bile. That's where the bile is made. So the gallbladder is really more of a storage vehicle.
Okay, thank you. Hey, Susan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Susan.
Let's see, what number is that? That's a one. Okay. Byron. Okay, Byron, you're on.
Yes, I was just wondering the doctor's stance on immunizations and vaccinations.
Yeah,
sir.
Yeah, so
this is a trick question, Byron.
Is it what?
Is this a trick question?
It is not. I was just wondering what is the
Because you know this is a very political question you're asking.
Yeah, well, it's certainly.
All right. Well, I didn't want to know any about it. So I was just curious.
There's certainly a great deal of debate about the potential risks of vaccines, Byron, and a lot of this initially was prompted by concerns about autism, particularly mercury, thimerosal, which is a mercury-containing ingredient of some vaccines. The data has not borne out to suggest many of the concerns to be high risks, whether that be autism, whether it be, cancer, whether it be autoimmunity. I can tell you that both my kids who have since grown had their full slate of vaccinations. I take my flu shot every year as a healthcare professional. I do make sure that there's no thimerosal in any vaccine, and the FDA is pretty much, closing the door on that. So vaccines are generally thimerosal-free or should be. I would never recommend that a parent not vaccinate their child. And we are starting to see some outbreaks of measles, things that historically we've had under control,
or right?
Diphtheria. Yeah. But I understand that some parents may be concerned, particularly if their children have learning disabilities. But I think that the most of the data continues to suggest that the overwhelming benefit of vaccines far exceeds their risk.
Right.
Okay. Hey,
well, my thought is that
go ahead.
It seems like they keep taking things out of vaccines to make them less poisonous.
Yes.
But if those poisons start in there and they're very dangerous, why take any risk at all on possibly or potentially harming a child or an infant?
Yeah.
And on the other side, what if you could get whooping cough, diphtheria, or any of the other diseases?
Yeah. Thimerosal has been the main concern, and that has since been removed. Yeah. When I was training, I had the opportunity to meet Jonas Salk, and when I was at Mass General Hospital. And, we forget that polio killed many kids and adults. Sure. And vaccination has all but eliminated polio as a risk.
In this country.
Yeah. So it's easy historically, particularly for those that have been born in recent years, to underappreciate the profound value that vaccinations have had from a public health perspective. But it's not without concern. I think anything we put in our bodies is reason to at least be better educated and better informed.
Byron, thanks for the great call. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Byron.
Okay. 1-800-348-2551. We're a little bit behind. Let's take a break.
Support for WAMC comes from Kent School, working to help students develop their passions and a lifelong love of the arts. kent-school.edu. Berkshire Medical Center's Joint Replacement Program, private rooms, pre-surgical education, rehabilitation, program coordinator, and 6 orthopedic surgeons. 413-395-7680. The Berkshire Fringe, presenting Riot, an epic tale of violence, greed, and cheap sofas. Now through August 13th at Simon's Rock, Great Barrington, berkshirefringe.org. 20th Century Illuminations, New Salem, Massachusetts, presenting Beyond Genocide, the traveling exhibition of contemporary illuminated manuscripts. manuscripts exploring the international legacy of genocide to 0thcenturyilluminations.com. And Snow Farm, Williamsburg, Massachusetts, a New England craft program offering workshops for adults and teens taught by master craftspeople on a 50-acre farm. Snowfarm.org.
Okay, and we are back. Let's go to Carol in New Paltz. Carol, you're on.
Hi. Let's see. I walk my dog on a hill on my road, and I used to be able to walk up without any difficulty. It's not terribly long or terribly steep. But as of this past spring, what I think is my aerobic lung capacity, is what I referred to it, seems to have seriously decreased. I mean, there are times when I have to stop two and three times while I'm going up this hill, just to catch my breath.
Yeah.
And I catch my breath rather quickly, you know, within a minute or so, I can walk again. But it has really concerned me that I have to stop this often. And just to give you a little background, I did mention it to my doctor. He did order a stress test, and from the stress test, it did show something positive. And from there, we actually went right to the heart catheterization, which turned out my heart was fine.
Mm.
And there are a couple of other theories at the moment, but I'm wondering if you have any other thoughts on the matter.
Yeah. Do you get short of breath when you're at rest, Carol, when you're laying in bed at night or
recumbent? No, and I'm really pretty fine when I'm on a flat surface.
Yeah.
If I were to really overexert myself on a flat, if I were to run, which I'm not a runner, but yes, I would still feel it in my chest.
Yeah. Well, I think it's appropriate to be mindful of any change in pattern. So, you know, as you've noticed differences in your breathing with exertion that in the past you've not experienced, it obviously raises some questions about what may be changed there. And the cardiology evaluation you've had from what you've described is really very extensive. And that certainly would be the do not miss scenario, making sure that the pumping of the heart is adequate and that there are no blockages in the coronary arteries. I mean, those would be the most serious causes for some interval change in aerobic capacity. Most commonly, these are issues of deconditioning, but I'm not sure that's what you're describing.
Are you getting older, Carol?
Well, it's better than the alternative.
Yeah.
Let's see. Yes. Well, I'm in my late 50s, but I do swim. I play tennis. I do hike. I can't say I'm in great. I can't claim to be in great aerobic shape, but I didn't do much over the wintertime. But I'm active.
Yeah. Hey, Carol. I'm so sorry. We got four people behind you. We're going to let you go. And thanks for the great call, because a lot of people have your situation. Believe me, they do. Thanks again, Carol. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Let's go to Sharon in Oak Hill. Sharon, you're on.
Hello. I'm curious about the use of pyrenethol for the treatment of colitis. I've been on it long-term. I was wondering what the effects would be long-term.
Yeah, you know, it's a medicine I'm not familiar with, Sharon, at least not by that name.
What about mercaptopurine?
Okay, mercaptopurine, and that's a more familiar form. And you've been on it for how long?
2 years.
Okay. How is it working for you?
It's working well.
Yeah. So mercaptopurine is in a family of anti-inflammatory medications that works by sort of inhibiting the replication of inflammatory cells. It actually sort of inhibits the DNA replication. And the track record from a safety perspective has been very, very good. I've used this on the remote pass for some kidney problems. It has a history in the transplant literature, again, more remote literature. So I think if you're finding that it's working for you, it's probably something that is relatively safe. The two big issues, and generally they manifest early on within the first 6 months, would be inflammation of the liver. So just checking, you know, routine blood tests would pick that up, of course. And the other is the bone marrow and making sure that the blood counts aren't being suppressed in any way. Usually they will manifest within the first several months, but though I'm sure you have those blood tests monitored periodically. But,
I do.
But I think if you're getting relief, I would say you're in a pretty good place there.
Okay.
Thanks, Sharon.
Thank you.
Yep. Let's go to Charles in Woodstock. Charles, you're on.
Hi, Alan. Hi, Dr. Pettis.
Hi, Charles.
This is Charles from Spark, Dr. Pettis.
Yes.
Participated in my evaluation last year.
Yes.
I'm just curious. I don't have a particular symptom to talk to you about, but considering your background and some of the things that I've heard are going on, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the future of integrative medicine in the St. Peter's system.
Yeah. Well, thank you for asking that. And certainly, that's my vision, Charles, is to develop more integrated models of care at St. Peter's.
What does that mean, integrative model?
And integration is a word that's used commonly and means different things to different people. But I think of integration as really leveraging all that we know to promote health and to manage disease. So there's a much greater emphasis on nutrition. There's a much greater emphasis on meditation and mindfulness. There's a much greater emphasis on tested interventions that might include acupuncture, which I know Charles has some expertise in, to massage therapy. So it attempts to develop models that really integrate various modalities that go beyond just medications.
Well, one of the things it brings up, which is so interesting, that I'm glad Charles brought it up, is that, you know, in this day and age, especially when you get to my age, you begin to have different doctors for different things.
Right.
You've got all these guys out there. You've got a gastroenterologist. You got somebody who's dealing with your osteopenia. You've got somebody who's dealing with this and that.
Yeah, you got a doc for everything. Yeah.
You got a doc for everything. And, you know, they really don't talk to each other a lot.
Right.
Unless you sort of ask them to.
Yeah.
And so this whole idea of integrative medicine, not only in terms of integrating, you know, sort of outside non-traditional things, but integrating all your doctors,
yes,
is very important.
Yes,
we don't do it.
Absolutely. So, good point, Alan. Yeah, you know, I think Charles, it clearly this is the trajectory that we need to be moving in, both in our hospital systems as well as in our outpatient and ambulatory models of care. Most major medical centers now either have or are developing integrated models of care. There is a national consortium of academic medical schools that are now developing curriculum for education, as well as care models that more thoughtfully integrate holistic models of care. And St. Peter's, in my humble objective opinion, is perfectly poised to be moving in this direction. Just recently, I started a division of integrated medicine within my department. I believe it's the only one
department
of its kind. Department of
Medicine.
At St. Peter's. I believe it's the only one of its kind right now in the Albany area. And I know there's a lot of interest from many providers and from our senior leadership. So this, it is time. And I find that my colleagues are very enthusiastic about it. I just recently presented this model to our medical executive committee, which includes all of our clinical and non-clinical leadership, and there was enthusiastic support to be moving forward.
Charles, we've got to thank you.
I hope to continue to be part of it, Dr. Pettis.
Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you, Charles, for your work, Charles, and for your service.
Okay, let's go to Chuck in Saratoga Springs. Chuck, you're on.
Hi, Doctor.
Hi, Chuck.
I have three questions about cipro-induced tendinitis.
Yeah.
My wife and I believe that she's basically suffering from this. And it's really hard to find out a lot about it, although it seems like there's a lot of people out there with this.
Yeah.
My questions really come down to, is there any way to positively identify this? And then, are there any treatments you would recommend? And then thirdly, can you recommend any doctors who specialize in this so we could actually really get on this for her?
Yeah, I'll start with the third question. I'm not aware
Start with the definition of cipro.
So cipro is a type of antibiotic most commonly used for urinary tract infections, for bladder infections.
Okay.
And there is a very good literature that connects cipro with tendinitis. Most of what has been reported is in the Achilles tendon.
Interesting.
And it's unclear why that is a more common target. And I'm not aware that there's very good understanding in terms of what the mechanisms are that link Cipro with, in this case, Achilles tendonitis. I don't know where your wife's tendonitis is, Chuck, but that's what's most widely described in the literature. It is a very hard diagnosis to confirm. There's no test that will confirm it. It would be a matter of really observing the onset after starting a medicine and then seeing some resolution after discontinuing the medicine would be the only clear way to establish cause and effect. So the first thing I would be doing would be to see if there were alternatives to Cipro for whatever it is that the Cipro is being used to treat.
Yeah, this came on a few months after the Cipro,
yeah,
which according to our reading is very common.
Yeah.
And then it causes, from what we've been reading, almost permanent damage to the tendons.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think in terms of treatment, if she's off the Cipro and these are,
yeah,
let's say, delayed effects, you know, certainly physical therapy, which might include ultrasound treatments, you know, sometimes they can do electrical stimulation.
She's had some of that and it hasn't responded well.
Okay, yeah.
Which sounds very common with this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's, I guess my advice in terms of who to see, because it sounds like you're doing a lot of the things that I would be recommending, would be to consider seeing a physiatrist. These are physicians that really train specifically in rehabilitative medicine. They're not orthopedic people. I think an orthopedic physician would not have a lot to offer unless the tendon were ruptured and you needed surgical intervention. A physiatrist, on the other hand, is going to really look at this from a functional perspective. Some of the techniques that we just talked about, the ultrasound, the nerve stimulation, the electrical stimulation, might be part of that. But I think the emphasis would be on trying to look at ways to reduce the inflammation and to preserve the integrity of the connective tissue itself.
Do you have physiatrists market at St. Peter's?
We no longer have them on campus at St. Peter's. They're certainly out there in the St. Peter's community.
And how do you how would Chuck find one?
If you if you just Googled physiatry in Albany, New York, you'll come up with a few names.
Saratoga Springs.
If you get into the St. Peter's, find a physician. It can break down the specialty, and you can look for them under that particular name.
You go to the St. Peter's webpage, and there'll be a Find a Physician.
Yes.
Search
engine. Yeah, in their portal. Yeah.
Okay.
Hey,
so,
Chuck, we can let you go. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your help.
Yeah. Thanks, Chuck.
Let's go to Jason in Malta. Jason in Malta, you're on.
Yeah. How you doing? I just was curious. What are some of the early symptoms of cirrhosis of the liver, and can it be sexually transmitted?
Cirrhosis of the liver, from the perspective that hepatitis, and more commonly hepatitis B, is sexually transmitted. So you could get hepatitis B through sexual transmission, and over time, usually months to many years, that could lead to more advanced liver disease and cirrhosis.
Cirrhosis scarring of the tissue?
So cirrhosis is scarring of the liver, and the early manifestations of that would be swelling. So that would be retention of fluid in the feet and ankles, and particularly in the abdomen. One might notice their abdominal girth getting larger, so your pants are fitting more tightly. People can sometimes notice changes in their skin. We call them spiders. So they're like little blood capillaries that are very superficial. You put your finger on them, they disappear. You lift your finger and they reemerge. Certainly jaundice, which is an accumulation of bilirubin, because the livers aren't detoxifying well, can begin to create a slightly yellowish discoloration of the whites of the eye. And sometimes that's not as apparent to the person that has it as it might be to a friend or family member who is observing you and, you know, might point that out. Blood testing is a very quick way to assess, in general, how much active inflammation there is in the liver. There's certainly testing for hepatitis. The three most common causes of cirrhosis would be alcohol, number one, hepatitis C, which is rapidly advancing. It's really quite prevalent.
And is that sexually transmitted?
It's not typically thought to be. It's a very low risk compared to hepatitis B from a sexual transmission. Hep C is more commonly IV drug use.
Interesting.
So those are the things that one can do to test and diagnose. Some people ultimately need a liver biopsy.
Guess what, guys? Jason, we're out of time. Doc, we're out of time. We are so sorry. And we want to apologize to Nancy from Plattsburgh. She is the unlucky one out. Again, everybody, thanks for being with us on the Vox Pop. The hospital's support for Medical Monday comes from the Hospital of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley, health-quest.org for locations, and Woodland Pond at New Paltz, independent retirement living in cottages on or one or two bedroom apartments, assisted living, memory care, and skilled nursing, all on the same campus, 845-256-5520. Thanks, everybody, for joining us today on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been the fabulous Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Daryl Bart, also fabulous. Our producer is Patrick Donjes, also fabulous. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.